Ms. Bertocci, move on with waste discharge application. And I think we'll start with her quick introduction of what department staff is online with us.
Okay, I'm bringing up my screen again. I hope everyone can see. Oops, wrong one. I'll scroll down. Here we are. Nordic has, as you all know, applied for a waste discharge license to
can
operate.
Can you let us know what staff are on, on with us too?
Okay.
Yeah.
The staff who have joined the meeting are Brian Cavanaugh, who's the Bureau Director for the Water section of the department, Greg Wood, Division Engineer, Division Director, Senior Environmental Engineer, Rob Moeller, Senior Environmental Engineer, and Angela Brewer, who is a biologist for the department. Okay, Nordic has applied for a waste discharge license for the proposed facility. And as I noted earlier, they have a proposed wastewater treatment plant that's going to be located proximate to Route 1, and that will be treating both the incoming fresh water and salt water that will be used in their grow-out facilities, and will also be treating the wastewater before discharge into Belfast Bay. There's a variety of techniques that are used throughout their process, including drum filtration for mechanical and biological treatment of incoming water, as well as, I believe, some of the wastewater. There are aerobic moving bed bioreactors that reduce organic matter and are involved in denitrification of some of the water, chemical precipitation of phosphorus, microfiltration in membrane bioreactors, sometimes referred to in the record as ultrafiltration because they're proposing 0.04 micron membranes to be used for that portion of the treatment. The wastewater treatment plant will obviously generate sludge that will be dewatered, and that material, the supernatant, would be returned to the treatment process. And before any discharge into Belfast Bay, there is ultraviolet disinfection of the effluent. So much of the information in the record involves the water wastewater treatment components. And then the next major component is the modeling of the discharge into Belfast Bay and how that water would, how the effluent would mix with the waters of the bay. Board members have received a briefing memo from staff looking at a number of the parameters associated with the effluent, including the temperature of the effluent, how it is diluted in the bay, both the near field and far field dilution, the effect of the biochemical oxygen demand and total suspended solids on water quality. And they also address effluent monitoring and ambient water quality monitoring, and total nitrogen and how total nitrogen is dispersed in the bay. And with that, I will turn it, I'll bring up just these two maps. Again, the quality here isn't great, and when we moved it over, we lost a lot of the wording on the maps, but these are attached to the board's, to the staff's memo to the board. So this one showing where monitoring occurred, and this one shows the, here we have the proposed development site. If you can see my cursor moving, this is the reservoir, Belfast Reservoir number one, the Little River, coming out the mouth of the Little River. The red dots here indicate wastewater, existing wastewater outfalls here and here, and the proposed one here. These are various monitoring points marked in yellow. The red areas indicate where the shore was surveyed for eelgrass, and I believe the only actual eelgrass at this point is down in this area, but I will let staff comment on that. But these maps are a little bit clearer in the attachments that the board members received. And from at that point, turn it over. I'll stop the screen share, and we'll go to staff.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Greg Wood. As Ms. Bertocci said, I am the director of the Division of Water Quality Management. And I'd like to, first of all, start with going over some very general concepts and terminology to help you understand how we assess proposed discharges, whether it be from this facility or any other facility, and how we assess whether the impacts or lack thereof to the receiving water. So what I'd like to start with, if it's okay with you, I only have three subject matters. I'd like to start with the difference between technology-based limits and water quality-based limits, because that is discussed at length. All discharges are subject to the requirement that the effluent limitations that are required must have the application of best practicable treatment, and that's right in state law. In addition, further on down in that section in the law, it actually describes what best practicable treatment is. And I'll just read from the law. Best practicable treatment means the methods of reduction, treatment, control, and handling of pollutants, including process methods, and the application of best conventional pollutant control technology or best available technology economically achievable for a category or class of discharge sources that the department determines are the best calculated to protect and improve the quality of the receiving water and that are consistent with the requirements of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act or the Clean Water Act as amended and published in the 40 Code of Federal Regulations. And then also part of that, it says, if no applicable standards exist for a specific activity or discharge, the department must establish limitations on a case-by-case basis using best professional judgment after consultation with the applicant and other interested parties of record. So I want to start out with best practicable treatment. So best practicable treatment essentially levels the playing field for a class of dischargers. And it does not actually dictate what the hardware is for the treatment. It actually dictates what the concentrations and or mass numbers are going to be coming out of a treatment plant that represents something that is affordable to a class of dischargers. And let me try to give you an example of what I mean, and I'll try to keep this thing local. So the Belfast Wastewater Treatment Plant is required to provide a secondary level of treatment, and technology standards in our rules and in the Clean Water Act require that for biochemical oxygen demand and total suspended solids, that they're required to meet as a monthly average 30 milligrams per liter and 45 milligrams per liter, as well as an 85% removal rate. So it doesn't matter if this treatment plant, which is required to have secondary, is in Belfast, Maine, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, or Kansas City, Missouri, they have to meet 30 milligrams per liter and 45 is a monthly average and a weekly average respectively. So it levels the playing field for all people. And another example would be the Northport Village Corporation. They are one of probably 15 to 20 facilities in the country that did get a waiver from secondary treatment. And best practicable treatment under federal regulations is the 30% removal of BOD and TSS. So they're not required to meet the 30 and 45 milligrams per liter. They're required to meet a percent removal. That's BPT for primary treatment facilities. And just to give you the context of where these folks actually perform, for the city of Belfast, their removal rates are on the order of 95 to 99% removal of the BOD and TSS coming into the treatment plant and then leaving. And Northport, even though it's only required to achieve 30% removal, actually achieves a 76% removal rate for BOD and a 90% removal rate for TSS, so which is pretty darn good. Now, there are also other types of technology-based BPT standards or technology-based limits, and they're found in national effluent guidelines that are published by the federal government. And a good example that I can give you would be a pulp and paper mill. For BOD and TSS in those permits, national effluent guidelines actually establish X number of pounds of BOD for every ton of production. So what we would do if we were writing a permit for a paper mill, we would just multiply the number of pounds of BOD times their production numbers, and we'll come up with what the technology-based limits would be for that facility. So that's just generally speaking how technology-based limits are established or implemented. And then what we do is we take those BPT limits that we have calculated, and we will send them over to our Division of Environmental Assessment, and they'll take those numbers and model those values to try to find out if those loads going into a receiving water can actually meet water quality standards. If they do, then everything is fine. We issue the permit as a technology with technology-based numbers. If they don't, then we need to go revisit what is the threshold in which you would have to limit the permit so that you don't have a violation of water quality standards. And let me give you a very brief example, and that would be the Androscoggin River with Gulf Island Pond. So just north of Lewiston and Auburn, there's a very large dam there that slows the water down. And above that, feeding Gulf Island Pond, is a medium-sized wastewater treatment plant at Livermore Falls. And then there are two large paper mills upstream from that. What happens there is that these discharges pile on top of each other, and they all end up in Gulf Island Pond. And the monitoring of Gulf Island Pond over the years has showed us that there were dissolved oxygen problems in there. It was not meeting standards. And also there were algal blooms in there because of excess phosphorus being discharged. So we had to assign water quality-based limits to all three of those facilities so that Gulf Island Pond would meet standards. So those are the differences between technology-based limits and water quality-based limits. The next area I want to go into is mixing and reasonable opportunity for dilution. And again, I'll refer back to the law. Section 451 of Maine law says the purpose of a mixing zone is to allow a reasonable opportunity for dilution, diffusion, or mixture of pollutants with the receiving water before the receiving water below or surrounding a discharge will be tested for classification standards or violations, excuse me. So there are rules that can give us guidance on how to establish near-field dilution factors. They're pretty clear, but there also is a requirement that we evaluate far-field dilution to deal with different parameters that have different response times. And that's the last section I want to get into, is this response time, because it's very important how we assess different pollutants. So you have there are some pollutants that have very short response times. An example would be chlorine, temperature, or say toxics. Those effects can happen within hours or single days after being discharged into an environment, depending on what the concentrations are. And I'll give you an example of what I mean by that. So I had a friend who wanted to go fishing one time, and he went and got some live bait at the local bait shop, brought the fish home, and decided that he wanted a different container to take his fish in. So he turned on the garden hose, filled up his container, threw his fish in there, and went fishing. By the time he got to his fishing hole, all the fish were dead. And so he couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, what he did is he actually lives in a community where he is supplied by a public drinking water supply. And as Mr. Parker said earlier in the day, there's very, very high levels of chlorine in that water. And to put it into perspective, most drinking water supplies will have anywhere from 500 parts per billion to 1500 parts per billion of total residual chlorine to make sure they maintain proper disinfection in their distribution systems. The freshwater acute criteria for freshwater is 19 parts per billion, and for marine water, it's 13 parts per billion. So he put his fish in chlorine levels that were 50 times higher than they could actually handle. And he just didn't understand it because he thought it was just water coming out of the faucet. So that's something that I would consider to be a short-term response. Now, there are other parameters that we're dealing with in this facility and others, at this proposed facility and others, and that would be the longer response times, and that would be associated with things like biochemical oxygen demand, which usually takes 5 days to exert its impact on the environment. And nutrients can be anywhere from 13 days to 14 days, or maybe even further than that. It all depends on what the environmental conditions are in the receiving water. So I just wanted to put some terminology and some perspective on how we actually look at these kinds of things. Does anybody have any questions so far?
I don't see any, so you may proceed.
Okay, so what I want to do is just kind of walk through those major points that Ms. Bertocci just put on the screen a little while ago, and I'll just go down in the same. I'm going to be very high level. I'm going to stay at the top of the trees. If you guys want to get down in the weeds, I do have other people on the phone here that can help me out, our water quality modeling engineer and our marine biologist. But let's start with temperature. Temperature was a subject that was talked about quite a bit at the hearing. And in our assessment of temperature, we utilized the highest temperature value that Nordic put in their application, which was 18 degrees C. They don't intend to discharge, according to their application, they don't intend to discharge if they are granted a permit. Will be discharged between 13 and 18, but usually right around 15 degrees. But we wanted to look at the worst case scenario. So we evaluated it based on 18 degrees. And there is a seasonality component to the regulation. You can't change the receiving water by more than 1.5 degrees between June 1st and September 1st. And I'll call that the summer season. And the non-summer season, you can't change it by more than 4 degrees. And changing the ambient, it says no discharge of pollutant shall cause the monthly mean of the daily max to be changed by more than that. So they're looking at daily maxes, the monthly mean of the daily max ambient conditions. So what we used was, again, the 18 degrees centigrade, which is 64.4 degrees Fahrenheit. We used, for summertime, we used 10 degrees C, which is 50 degrees in the month of June. So it's usually from June 1st to September 30. That's the coldest part of the season. And then in the non-summer season, we use 1.3 degrees centigrade or 34.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's in the month of March where the temperature are the lowest. We did those calculations and we calculated the temperature change in the receiving water based on the parameters that I just explained and concluded that if a permit were approved for this facility, that they would meet the temperature standards in the summertime and in the non-summertime. Anybody have any questions on that so far? Okay, hearing none, let's move into dilution factors, which is this reasonable opportunity for mixing. So like I said, when you're looking at near field dilution, we have a regulation, Chapter 530, which is Surface Waters Toxic Control Program, and it makes it very clear how you calculate dilution factors in the near field for both freshwater and marine. The applicant in their application did that and suggested that the acute near-field dilution factor was 10 to 1 and that the chronic dilution factor was 15 to 1. We reviewed those modeling results and agreed that that was a reasonable thing to do. What's a little more difficult is assessing the far-field dilution. There is no state guidance or federal guidance on how to calculate far-field dilution. There is some talk of it in the technical support document that we cited in this memo, but it's not very clear, and they essentially leave it up to the regulating authority to use best professional judgment on how to do this. So the far field is less clear. So in a November 3rd, 2019 amendment to the application for a waste discharge permit, the applicant created a graph that showed how they were looking at the far field dilution. This gets a little complicated, so I'm trying to make it very simple. So it's our understanding what they did was they took, and I'll just use ping pong balls. They took this circulating model that they had, and they were taking particles and actually mathematically putting them into the water and trying to find out after 2 days, what was the dilution associated with each one of those particles? And they created four graphs. And one of the graphs, which they used to calculate their dilution, far field dilution factor, was the 50th percentile, meaning that 50% of the particles were greater than X dilution factor and 50% were lower. And they did this out over 20 days long. So they kept tracking what was the dilution associated with particles that were 2 days old. And based on that, the applicant indicated that the far field dilution factor in their mind was 300 to 1. And the department misinterpreted what they were actually saying, because we interpreted that as being the mean. Again, we're going to go back to response times. The response times are anywhere from 3 to 14 days. They were looking at 2 days. So they're already conservative in that sense, is that they were looking at a shorter response time. And that 300 to 1 that they identified as being the far field dilution factor was actually the lowest dilution factor associated with any of the 2 day particles. And the department would not look at it that way, and we would look at it as a longer term averaging rather than taking the absolute lowest dilution factor on that. So we misinterpreted the graph that the consultant sent to us. So when we wrote this memo and used the 300, again, that was based on a misinterpretation by the department of the graph that they had submitted. So we looked at that graph a little closer, and if you look at longer averaging times, we've estimated the dilution factor be more on the order of 530 to 1, which according to the graph is 10 times 2 to the 7th power. So we were overly stringent in our review of this because of our misinterpretation, and we think that the applicant was way too conservative because that would have been inconsistent the way we look at these far field dilution factors and have been for the last couple of years. So we would recommend that 300 to 1 is too stringent and that 530 is a more appropriate far field dilution factor. So we would have to modify the calculations that we did in our memo. Are there any questions so far?
Thousands. A lot of that math went over my head, I'll confess right now. But why don't we simply proceed from here and see if there's any other questions that are more clarifying than I can ask. I see none, so I will try to catch up.
Okay. So let's proceed to effluent monitoring and ambient water quality monitoring. I think one of the misconceptions at the hearing was the issue, if this facility were to be issued a permit for the proposed discharge, that the department would just evaluate this the way we have here and then just walk away, and that's not what happens. When MEPDS permits are issued, they're issued with limitations, special terms and conditions, and routine monitoring requirements. And those routine monitoring requirements can be at a frequency of once a day to once per year. So they permittees monitor their effluent every month. They summarize their results. They give us the raw data, and they submit it electronically to the department and EPA, who has oversight over the program in Maine. We are a delegated state, but EPA still always has the oversight. So we go through all of the data every month, and we have a committee here made up of people who are in the compliance section, the enforcement section, and the permitting section. And we go through all of the discharge monitoring reports, is what they're called. We go through them every single month, and we look for non-compliance. And what we're really trying to identify is, are there chronic compliance problems out there or not? And are our facilities actually meeting all the terms and conditions of their permit? And so we would see nothing different. If you were to issue a permit for this proposed facility, we would see that to be no different than any other permit that we issue. And as far as ambient water quality monitoring, it is not uncommon for MEPDS permits to have conditions above and beyond just establishing either water quality-based limits or numeric limits and the routine monitoring, to have actual ambient water quality monitoring to help the department and the permittee understand what's actually going on in the receiving water, especially if there's any question mark, or there is just insufficient amount of information. So if you remember, with the permittee has actually drafted a applicant permit which did have a number of ambient water quality monitoring conditions in it, and there, if a permit were to be issued, they are agreeing to do things like a dye study and to do ambient water quality monitoring at stations that the department has already done some ambient water quality monitoring at. And so this would add to and have a more robust database for what's actually going on in the receiving water. And it'll they have also agreed to do a dye study. And I think if you remember at the hearing that Dr. Pettigrew, who was, I believe, hired by the Upstream Watch or representing the Upstream Watch's concern, did have a conversation with the modeler from Nordic. And I think it was agreed that doing a dye study would be helpful for everybody to try to understand what's actually going on in the bay and actually try to get to verify or refute the dilution factors that we're talking about, because there is, as I said before, an awful lot of best professional judgment when it comes to these, especially the far field dilution factor. So it's my understanding that these folks, again, based on the permit that they drafted and submitted to you folks, that they're willing to do that ambient water quality monitoring.
I hate to interrupt briefly here, but do I understand correctly that this would be before any construction takes place? They do the dye test out where the discharge will be, and that'll inform us?
No, they would not be able to do that, because in order to do that, you have to have the flow going. You have to have flow going out of the water. I mean, out of the discharge pipe,
right,
in order to be able to do that.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
Yep. So are there any questions on ambient water quality monitoring or effluent?
Mr. Sanford has one. We're not hearing you, Mr. Sanford.
I have a quick one, Bob, if you hear me.
I thought I heard a ping.
Jim. It's Jim, yeah.
I wasn't quick enough.
Okay. All right, Rob lost his place. We're going to Mr. Parker, and then I'm coming back to Mr. Sanford.
I had a real quick little question, Greg. As you talk about the dilution factor, they had 300, you wanted like 570. But in the literature we were sent a few days ago, we said 1,000 to 1.
No, that was, the far field dilution factor to assess the impacts of nitrogen and BOD on dissolved oxygen in the receiving water were based on the 300, which we're going to call now we're proposing 530. That 1,000 to 1 was the dilution associated with looking at the eelgrass as being an environmental response indicator. That is
okay.
That is much further away from where the far field dilution is.
Okay, I'm back with you. Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Sanford.
This is Rob. Do you see a distinction between proposed conditions or activities that the applicant is offering versus some that you think need to be done to make a positive finding?
I think that the conditions they have proposed are sufficient. I don't think there are any in there that we would go above and beyond. I think that we could answer any questions that we need based on what they have proposed.
Okay.
So do we want to go to nitrogen now?
I have a question or two, and maybe this is not the right time for it. One of the things that was a major discussion was the configuration of the bay itself, how much water is sloshing back and forth so that, yes, you have dispersion, but then it all washes back into the next tide, and you have, with certain weather conditions, the opportunity to pile up some of these factors so that all the ping pong balls are coming back together again or never dispersed in the first place. How much confidence do we have in that modeling at this point?
I think I'd like to divert that conversation or that question to our water quality modeling person, Mr. Moeller.
Okay.
Rob, Rob, could you weigh in on that, please?
Sure. This is Rob, and I will try, and feel free to interject. So modeling is a real tricky science, and we try to model the absolute worst possible condition. And so in this case, the hydrodynamic model of this nature, we know how high the tides are. We know how much water is coming down the river. So in terms of quantity of water, we've got a fairly refined understanding of that. The tide charts, everyone can refer to those, and they're pretty accurate. So that's a pretty good quantification of the amount of water moving around. Now, that's not to say there aren't other factors, but that's the primary driver in this model, and I think we've got a high level of confidence with that. So then you mentioned other factors, weather, and probably wind is the only other factor that can really drive anything to any significance there. And the assumption with this model is there is no wind, because the wind actually increases mixing. And so worst case would be there's no wind out there pushing things one way or another. And so that's how we arrive at a very conservative assumption. There were a lot of comments in that regard, but there's no question in my mind that these wind-driven functions would greatly increase the amount of dilution. Certainly in this, we use this term far, certainly in the near field, and even in the far field, which is still a near field. I mean, the area that we're talking about with regard to these dilution numbers is still a very small fraction of this resource. Whether you look at it as Belfast Bay or even the larger, even much larger aspect of Penobscot Bay. So I feel confident that we're coming at it from a pretty conservative standpoint.
Okay, the basis of the question, of course, I think comes down to Mr. Pettigrew's testimony, Dr. Pettigrew, that maybe we were misunderstanding what the currents in the bay were doing based on historical results. And there was also the difficulty, there was some testimony from another witness that we should consider all of Penobscot Bay, even though a lot of the water doesn't actually pass through Belfast Bay, goes out around some of the other islands. So some of the modeling came into question, and I want to get a sense of what the department's competence is and the actual understanding of how that bay works. And I also just point out that it's sort of a cul-de-sac and that it's tucked right back into Belfast. It's bordered on one side by Sears Island, Islesboro the other way. So some of that water is contained. So how does that affect your model?
I would suggest that it really doesn't affect it too much, because much of, and I think Dr. Pettigrew is correct in what he says in a very broad sense about the circulating nature of what goes on there. To be honest with you, that has very little influence on this area where we're calling the far field, which is still fairly localized to the discharge location. It plays a role in certainly the overall circulation in Penobscot Bay, but it you know, the primary drivers in this localized area are the coming and going tides, and to some degree the river flows. So no one's wrong in that discussion, but I don't think it plays a significant role in what's been modeled.
Okay, yeah, the urgency, I think, of being as correct as we can be in the circumstances is we're talking about doing monitoring and dye studies, but that's after we've already permitted the project and it's been built. So how much confidence do we have going into this?
Yep, and so actually that was, I think that was the second part of your question was, you know, how much, Penobscot Bay is an enormous resource in relation to what we're modeling here, and the 500-to-1 dilution area is, I think we saw some video demonstrations during some of the earlier proceedings, and I think we saw a blue blob kind of migrating back and forth out there, and you know that was a very small area in relation to Penobscot Bay.
So go ahead.
Can
you help me understand the 500-to-1 number? You talk about the ratio, but I don't actually understand what the 500 and the 1 are, because I got lost.
It's just a relative dilution within this confined area where I think Greg did actually a better job than I did in trying to describe its significance, but we. At some point, we have to draw a line and say, this is where the outfall plume has evolved to a point whereby what's its influence in the bay? And that where that line is roughly the blue blob that we saw, which is, you know, still fairly close proximity to the outfall.
I guess my question is, what is the 500 and what is the 1 that is part of this ratio?
The 1 is the effluent, and the 500 is the bay.
Is the dilution, essentially.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And if you were, and just to carry that out, I think someone in the earlier proceedings had thrown out a number of 7 trillion gallons, you know, of Penobscot Bay, you know, some reference volume. If you actually translated that into this equation, it would be vastly greater than 500-to-1. So
yes, I remember personally questioning that stat.
Yep.
Okay. Any other questions from board members? I don't see a mic on. Ms. Bertacci, did you have something to add?
I have a question, and I don't know whether it's best at this point or later. But there was also a testimony regarding the buoyancy of the effluent compared to the receiving water, and criticism of the model sort of being two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional, and would there be a likelihood of perhaps more in the near field versus the far field of sort of a lens of more concentrated water, more concentrated effluent in that water column. And so could you just speak to any concerns that there might be about that or not?
You want me to go with that one, Greg?
Sure. I think Angie might have something to say about that also.
So the concern is that the expectation is that the effluent will rise to the surface. It's less dense than the bay water itself, so it's going to spill out of the outfall pipe and then tend to rise to the surface. And there are times of the year where those density gradients are, it's all based on salinity and temperature. And there are, those do change. The bay changes during different times of the year. But I think we're confident that the presiding influence is going to be buoyancy, and that it won't become trapped.
Just to follow up on that, or alternatively, floating in the lens on the surface. People, you know, commenting about recreational boating in the area and concerns about whether or not the buoyancy of the effluent would cause it to rise to the surface and create, I don't know, a scum for lack of a better word, a lens of contaminated effluent across the surface that would impair recreational use of the water body.
I that wasn't specifically looked at, and that's primarily because that wasn't a concern of ours. But it's that surface lens. That's not very likely. It is a two-dimensional model, and it assumes that there's a that surface lens is roughly. I'd have to remember, but so it's a depth average model, but I don't think there's any concern that's just going to create this very thin lens on the surface.
Ms. Brewer, go ahead and jump right in.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to speak a little bit to the environmental impact of the buoyancy discussion. So it's actually preferable to have a positively buoyant plume if the concern is impacts on one dissolved oxygen. Typically, we would see lower dissolved oxygen concentrations in the bottom water, which was observed when we did our monitoring efforts in 2019. So having a buoyant plume would actually remove spatially the impact of that effluent on lower dissolved oxygen water. So that's beneficial. Additionally, there were a lot of concerns issued about impacts on lobster that were on the bottom. So by having that buoyant plume, it also moves that impact potentially away from the adult lobster that are on the benthic surface on the bottom. So it's actually preferable to have that plume popping up to the surface. And I also wanted to mention that, and Greg may get to this later, or Mr. Wood may get to this later, but all the calculations that were done for nitrogen background concentrations, those are all based on surface values. So the assumption is that if the plume is buoyant, that it would be affecting the surface water. So that's sort of the basis for my interpretations as well, for the memo that was assembled by Mr. Wood.
Another question, probably mostly for my own peace of mind, but the amount of water or effluent is going to be pretty constant at 7 million gallons or something like that, as I recall. But weather is not a constant, neither is the season, and you have three rivers that are feeding in here as well. After a good rainstorm, I think an inch of rain is about 27,000 gallons per acre. Then you've got all the water, fresh water coming out of the rivers and whatever that's carrying, running into this additional 7 million gallons. Is there a cumulative impact here from all that we need to be worried about, such that it could, that much impact all at once could snuff out a fishery with the additional effluent they were contributing here?
I wouldn't guess. I mean, that's an interesting question. What you're saying is what happens naturally in this system. All the time. I mean, it's very dynamic.
Right.
It's very dynamic. It's it is a result of exactly what you're describing. So I, you know, that's kind of built into the modeling that was done. So no, I mean, the model, the best we can do with this modeling is characterize its influence on this specific ambient environment. And I would argue that that's all built into to what Penobscot Bay is.
Yeah, one of the things I've been wrestling with, I think, during the testimony itself and then afterwards, is you do have three rivers that are contributing into Belfast Bay. Of the four sources of fresh water and water coming in, the pipeline is actually the smallest, I think. Does that by any chance cause us to tip over into a problem, or is it just one small contributor in the greater picture of things? I never could get a grasp on that from the testimony.
Nothing of that suggests a problem to me. I mean, it's you know, the 500-to-1 kind of is kind of a reflection of that. It is of its significance within this system and within that area. So I would not presume. I'm not 100% sure where the question's going, but this is not a full. It only has the capacity to have, you know, the significance where we're suggesting, really. I mean, it is 7 million gallons per day of water, which is, you know, a fraction of all these various other inputs that we're talking about.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, Mr. Pelletier, you seem ready.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I did have a question, but Angela answered it very well just a couple minutes ago. I'm sorry, I should have unmuted myself.
Okay. Seeing nothing else from the board, you may proceed.
So I only have two more subject matters here that are in the memo that we prepared, and one was biochemical oxygen demand and total suspended solids. As we talked about earlier, when I first started out, under best practicable treatment requirements in the law, they're saying if there are no applicable best practicable treatment standards, then you use your best professional judgment. And in this particular case, there are no numeric BPT standards for BOD and TSS from a RAS facility. But the department did have some information based on a draft rule that EPA had put together back in 2002 that did include some numeric values for, I think it was TSS. And the department, and then when the final rule was issued, those went away and it became completely BMP oriented. So BPT in that sense was implement these BMPs and BPT is being satisfied. Well, we wanted to be more stringent than that because we did think that there was some value in those numeric values. And so we, as a best professional judgment, have adopted 30 milligrams per liter and 50 as a monthly average and 50 milligrams per liter as a daily max to be incorporated into RSA facilities. And we have done that in previous permits. And I don't see any reason why we wouldn't do the exact same thing if you folks were to proceed ahead with a proposed permit for this facility. So we are using best professional judgment. And if you, I'll just leave the memo as it is, even at 300, just for the sake of discussion for the far field dilution, because again, we're talking about response times here. This doesn't happen overnight. This takes 5 days to actually exert its impact, full impact. And there, you can't actually measure the impact to the environment on dissolved oxygen as a result of this discharge as proposed. Any questions on BOD and TSS? Again, I'm trying to keep this very high level. Unless you guys want to get down into the weeds, I'd be more than happy to do that.
I see nothing from the board, so you may proceed.
Okay, the last subject is nitrogen. Let's go back to BOD and TSS for a minute. Just as a point of clarification, is that those discharge levels that the facility said that they can meet or believe that they can meet if they're granted a permit, does represent a 99% removal rate. As I told you before, with the Belfast POTW and the Northport discharge, they're ranging anywhere from 75 to 95% or 99 or 98% BOD and TSS removal. So this facility is proposing a 99% removal. So nitrogen, the facility is, first of all, there are no, once again, there are no best practicable treatment standards for the discharge of nitrogen from RSA facilities. There are no national effluent guidelines. The state of Maine does not have any formally adopted ambient water quality criteria for nitrogen. But we do have, again, we're going to use our best professional judgment on work that had been done in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And we are using, in past permitting actions, we have been using thresholds to protect eelgrass as the environmental response indicator, and also another one for using dissolved oxygen as the response environmental response indicator. The permittee has put on the table that at 99% removal, that at, that 99% removal, their 23 milligrams per liter that they put on the table, they think they can meet, is based on a 99% removal of total nitrogen across the treatment plant, which is a pretty high level. So the department, as you can see in our calculations, we applied a, and we did this with BOD and TSS too. The anti-degradation policy for the state of Maine says you can't have a lowering of water quality, but if you do, you have to have a public participation as part of this process. And we also have a guidance document that has been reviewed by EPA and supported by EPA that puts a little bit of meat on the bones of the statute. And in there, we look at a threshold of 25% of the remaining assimilative capacity as being a lowering, you know, a significant lowering of ambient water quality. So when we did our calculations here, we actually applied, only gave the permittee, if you will, a proposal that they would only get a limitation that's only 20% of what the whole, with 100% of the assimilative capacity of the receiving water. So they're only going to get 20%. So what we did is we took the thresholds we had, using as our interim standard, if you will, and did the math on it. We established an ambient background condition of 0.25 milligrams per liter, ran the numbers, and if you use the new dilution factor of 530 to 1, which we think is appropriate, it results in an allowable discharge of 21 milligrams per liter, which is less than the 23 million milligrams per liter that the facility believes that they can attain. So that would be a lowering of water quality. So if a permit were to be issued and using dissolved oxygen as the environmental indicator response, this permit would be limited to a mass number based on 21 milligrams per liter being discharged. As far as eelgrass, again, eelgrass is much further away from the discharge pipe than the near field where we're looking at dissolved oxygen. And again, using the new dilution factor of 530 to 1, we estimated that the dilution down at the eelgrass bed is roughly three times higher than it is in the far field that we've calculated for dissolved oxygen. So now you're looking at a discharge, a dilution factor to protect the eelgrass around 1,590 to 1. And if you do the math on that, it comes out that the allowable discharge, if granted, would be 22 milligrams per liter, which again is still below the 23 milligrams per liter. So here you would be issuing, we would be issuing a proposed permit with water quality based limits. Now I do want you to keep in mind that this application of the 20% of only allowing a 20% of the remaining assimilative capacity for the facility doesn't mean That's the limit that has to meet and to not have water quality standards not being met. In other words, if we were to allow a permit that would consume 100% of the remaining assimilated capacity, this proposed facility or this proposed discharge would be actually allowed to discharge on the order of 105 to 110 milligrams per liter. All water quality standards will be met, all designated and existing uses we've met also. But this anti-degradation policy for new or increased discharges limits that to 20%. And if you want to make an argument to lower the water quality as a result of a higher limitation, you have to go through a public process and demonstrate that it's in the best interest and a social and economic benefit to the state. And it's my understanding to date, the permittee has not requested that additional incremental increase. So I will leave it at that for the time being, unless you guys have if you have more questions.
Yes, Mr. Pelletier does.
Just a quick question, Mr. Wood. I'm just making sure I want to see. I'm not seeing the math here, according to the narrative. The pages 86 and 87, the last couple of pages here. You were talking about for the DO as a 21 milligram per liter. And then again for the nitrogen, 22. I'm not seeing that in your figures here. Am I missing something?
I don't have the same page numbers you do, but you're in attachment E of the memo, correct?
Yep, I'm in the last two pages of attachment E.
Right. So on page 6 of 7,
yep, I'm there.
It's evaluating dissolved oxygen as the response indicator. So the critical threshold that we have been utilizing is 0.45 milligrams per liter. We have an ambient background based on data that the department collected of 0.25 milligrams per liter. The far field dilution factor, if we modify that to 531, which is again we think is appropriate, if you do the math down through there, you're going to end up with 530 times 0.04 will give you 21 milligrams per liter.
Hold on a minute, 0.04. All right. I got you.
Okay. Change that 300 to 530. Instead of having 12 milligrams per liter, the equation will yield a 21 milligrams per liter, I believe.
Okay. And the same thing happens over on the nitrogen, then. That's where
both of these are nitrogen.
For the effluent limitation.
For the eelgrass.
For eelgrass, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And, okay. And the dilution factor is higher because it's much further away from the far field dilution factor.
Quite a ways away, yeah.
We evaluate. Okay.
All right, thanks.
Okay, I hear a pen clicking, so I believe Mr. Parker has a question.
It's me, yeah. Greg, first of all, Greg, compliment, you're doing a good job today. But does the facility have the ability to meet the 22 milligrams? Can they modify the treatment to your knowledge to accomplish that?
Well, 22 milligrams per liter versus 23 milligrams per liter, you know, that's a pretty small margin. My guess would be that they would say, yes, we can tweak things to meet that number.
Now, how complex of a process would it be to get them to go for another 2 or 3%? Does that take quite a process?
Well, that 23 milligrams per liter already represents a 99% removal, so that's going to be tough.
No, but I'm misleading. I asked that wrong. Right now, you're looking at dedicating a specific percentage of the available capacity to that plant.
Correct.
For them to increase that by 2 or 3%, how complex a process would that be?
It is actually laid out in the memo. And that's on page 5 of 7 of attachment E.
Okay.
There are three bullets there. And if you want
to. Okay, so basically what they have a couple of options, and right, they could pursue that if they chose, or they could modify that process if they can accomplish it. So there's a couple possibilities for them to pursue.
Yes,
I would. If we wrote a license around this.
Yes, I would agree with you.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. So they have an opportunity. They're just going to decide how they want to proceed to accomplish it.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, thanks, Greg.
You're welcome.
We did have some testimony during the hearing about the fact that the microns on the filters are so small that you run a risk of clogging releases of bad stuff all at once as they try to fix it, UV lights that aren't working. Has the department looked at that issue as it affects the permit?
Well, they do have two treatment planes, two treatment trains, so they do have some redundancy there. And it's my understanding that each one of the treatment trains can actually treat the full discharge. So they, you could run them, you know, you can run them in parallel, or if you had to take one down for maintenance or cleaning, you can actually use the other one and still maintain production.
All right, I believe Mr. Boak has something to add.
I was responding to Jim Parker's comment, and I don't know if he was getting to operational changes by Nordic or the process to consider if there's going to be a lowering of water quality, what that would look like from the standpoint of what the board and the parties would need to do. But I guess I would just point this out for the board's consideration that under the state's statutory anti-degradation policy, if there is going to be a lowering of water quality, for instance, below the 23 milligrams that they've requested, and if the board is going to consider the findings that are required when that happens, and that involves that the action is necessary to achieve important economic or social benefits to the state, that would require a separate public participation requirement in addition and above and beyond of what's been happened. And so I just want to point that out and what that would generally look like. EPA has some more complex guidance on that process. I think Mr. Wood did point out some of the bullet points on board packet page 85 that appear in the department's guidance. I think EPA regulations and guidance materials have more in-depth descriptions of what would happen, but it is a process into and of itself that would involve likely opening up the record for some minimum amount of time of 30 days or so for extra evidence and then comment and perhaps briefing on that separate issue if one is going to try to make that finding. So if the board was inclined to go that route with those findings, it would need to consider that sort of a process.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions or input from the board? Seeing none, let's have a board discussion a little bit about what we've heard and what may concern us or not concern us. I'm looking for a volunteer to go first if there is anyone.
I got some comments. First of all, I want to compliment the staff on what they put together for us. They did a good job on that. I think the applicant's going to have to make a decision how they want to proceed on dealing with the nitrogen. Can they modify their process and accomplish that? If they can, that's one alternative, but they've got to be able to prove to us they can do it. The second one is, do they want to go through a process to try to, based on the economic benefit and all that stuff related that was discussed earlier in this information, and try to increase that number? Other than that, the BOD, the suspended solids, the mixing, I'm pretty comfortable with all that.
Mr. Pelletier? Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Ms. Bainsiger had buzzed in for a moment.
Actually, I think I was just trying to get your attention because Mr. Boak had some input.
Sure.
If we can go there first. Go ahead, Mr. Boak.
Yeah, to piggyback on what Mr. Parker was just saying and talking about options, I think with respect to nitrogen, there are several. I think that there is, with respect to what that requested component is, there's the option of denial. There's a second option of partial approval with what would be allowable absent a finding or the additional findings that would be needed for lowering of water quality at the 21 milligrams or whatever the new calculations that Greg referred to are in a partial build-out phase of just the first phase, so a partial approval at the existing amounts. There could be a third option of the approval for the full build-out at those same amounts that are below 23 milligrams, but beneath the level that would require the additional findings by the board on the social and economic benefits. Or fourth, that process of considering that different route of social and economic benefits.
Mr. Pelletier?
Well, now you've complicated what my question was. First, I thought that the Mr. Parker's comments were right on. You know, there's a couple issues here we need to ask the applicant. But Mr. Boak has provided a couple of other options here that I'm not sure what we might want to recommend here. You know, could you just briefly say those last two ones again, Scott? Your two last two recommendations, or maybe our Peggy's waiting too. I'm not sure.
Sure, Peggy, do you want to go first? I'm happy to answer that question.
Well, I just wanted to emphasize that at this point the record is closed,
Thank you, Peggy.
The board should be proceeding forward on the record before it. There is no request from the applicant to go down the route of an analysis of whether water quality could be lowered, and if it is lowered, is it okay if there's a social and economic benefit to the state that is demonstrated? So that really isn't before the board right now, and Scott can elaborate on that, but so I would recommend that the board go forward with what it has in the record before it, and there are, as Scott pointed out, some options, and Scott can maybe review those again.
Yeah, that fourth option of the social economic, that's so more hypothetical for the reasons Peggy just said. I mean, the record is closed, and if the board were to consider those types of findings, that's what the board would have to do. So I felt compelled to point that out, but it is more hypothetical because that has not been a process that's been pursued, and that's not where the proceedings are at right now. But backing up to the interim two before that, this is a phased project. It could be a partial approval of phase one is something for the board to consider. I don't know the applicant's views on that. At numbers that are lower than 23 milligrams, the numbers that Mr. Wood pointed out, that would be based upon their recalculated far field dilution, would be numbers that would not need to go through that additional findings of social and economic benefits, or the same sort of approach at full build out instead of a partial build out with just a number that's less than 23 milligrams, but 21 or the numbers that Mr. Wood pointed out.
Yep.
That's fine, Mr. Pelletier? Okay. Looking for other questions or input from the board, I will offer this in terms of after the fact monitoring and the dye testing. It does seem to me a prudent thing to do. We are taking some modeling on faith. It would be nice to see where those ping pong balls are going afterwards. My big question, I suppose, is, okay, what if those ping pong balls aren't going where we thought they would and everything is all built out? What are our options then?
Well, I think that the facility would either potentially modify their outfall structure, which they could do. I don't know what all the different alternatives they looked at. I know they looked at single port versus multi-port diffuser. You know, I don't know if it has to go out further. During this ambient water quality monitoring, they may find a current they could get to. I'm not really sure how in depth they've looked at all of this stuff. And/or they could modify their treatment plant. Maybe a new black box comes along that provides a higher level of treatment, and it doesn't become an issue. So I think there are things that they may have to look into if it shows that what you're suggesting.
Should the board go down the path of conditions approvals and permit, and the ping pong balls don't go where they are supposed to, are we now in a violation of the permit?
No, you wouldn't be in violation of the permit because there wouldn't be any violation of water quality standards. You have to remember the limitations that we have put forth in our memo are only eating up 20% of the remaining assembly capacity of the receiving one.
Okay, thank you. Any other?
I'm back.
Mr. Parker.
Perhaps as a way we could go at this, we're not talking about a phase one to phase two project. If they come back and recommend or make the comment to us that they could actually treat to below that 21 milligrams per liter, there's no reason we couldn't issue a permit if we chose to based on that, with a condition that before they expand the facility to phase two, they revisit the nitrogen analysis with us. Those are then, if they're meeting the 21, they're all set. If they're not meeting the 21, then before they expand, they've got to do something. And we won't know for sure what they're going to meet till they physically are discharging wastewater. They can claim they can do it, but there's no proof in it until it's done.
I understand what you're saying, but I think the problem there is, I think most of the pollutant loading is going to come from the adult fish and not the smolts and the fry. So I think phase one is the smolts and the fry, and I just don't think you're going to be able to judge until it's full build out and all the fish are in the tanks.
Well, I thought they were going to grow out some fish in phase one too.
I believe they are, aren't they?
Yeah, they're going to grow out fish in phase one, and then phase two will be sort of a duplicate of phase one.
No, I would agree with that, but I'm not sure that. I suppose they could do statistical analysis on doing monitoring based on just phase one, and then try to mathematically scale up to find out if they can actually meet 21 milligrams per liter, or whatever the number becomes. Again, that's this is no different than modeling. you're trying to interpolate out to something that isn't happening yet. The only way you're going to get true values is to actually make it happen. And
that's right. That's right. I'd like to find a way, if we do issue a permit, to find a way to give them the opportunity to try to go for the 21. And if they can make it, that's great. If the technology becomes limited before they go to phase two, then we have an option or an opportunity to do something different. Either not approve them phase two or make some other modifications.
Sure, understood. Yeah.
Speaking for myself, I guess I'm a little reluctant to engineer this for them in a permit. I think the record before us says what they think they can do, what we're willing to put up with, and that would be the condition I would start with. I would certainly applaud any improvements going forward, but to make that some kind of a condition, I might have a difficulty figuring out how to word that.
Well, see, the problem I'm having with it, Bob, is the number that we use for a percentage, the 20 or 25% or whatever it is a number that's been well thought out by the department, but it's an arbitrary number. Okay? Because it, as Greg said a while ago, somebody could discharge 100 and something milligrams per liter if they're allowed to use the whole zone, okay? So I'm saying it's not truly a totally arbitrary number, but it's a number that's been selected to work with. It seems to be working. So whether they end up limited to that or not is something we have to look at in the future. If they come out now and say they can treat and get 21 or less, then I want to have some provision there so that if they don't make it, because they're going to be asking for some pretty elaborate treatment to go below 21 with what they've projected today.
Mr. Pelletier.
The idea of going ahead with a kind of phase one study would also allow you to have kind of a functional
dye test too and see where things go. So there's that point.
Certainly building in some kind of review with the dye test and the monitoring between the phases is something I suspect the board is going to be comfortable with, because we are taking a lot of modeling on faith ahead of time. And so there is room for course correction to be anticipated. I guess I'm comfortable with that. Other input from the board or staff members? I see none. Mr. Pelletier, your mic is still on.
Just one quick comment on, I would commend the staff on doing a really good in-depth analysis and trying to make it somewhat understandable for someone like myself. Nice work. Thanks.